Chapter 18. While Dorothy Kilgallen may have kept the results of her investigation mostly to herself, she knew there was danger lurking from those who were closely watching her every move. To that end, she and Mark Lane carried on a clandestine relationship after the obsessed reporter told him, "Intelligence agencies will be watching us. We'll have to be very careful." When the two spoke on the telephone, they alternated phone booths. They also used code names, hers, Robinson, his, Parker. Of note is that during meetings with Lane at Kilgallen's home, Richard Colmar listened to some of their conversations. That either the CIA, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI agents, or those with something to hide about their participation in the JFK and Oswald assassinations, were monitoring every move Kilgallen made seems a given. Unlike any other reporter at the time, she possessed 1. Credible facts from credible sources only a reporter with her clout had access to, which became the basis for the numerous columns she wrote blasting the Oswald alone theory. 2. The ability to connect the Jack Ruby trial testimony with whatever information her sources provided. 3. Whatever Ruby told her during their private interviews. And 4. Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission, connecting with all of the facts she had uncovered on a daily basis. Kilgallen realized how significant her investigation had been to date. But while this was true, the danger level had increased significantly, since it was also known she was writing the book for Random House. Even if she had tried, Kilgallen could not have painted a larger target on her back. She was definitely in the crosshairs of enemies, since she would not give up nor stop her investigation. Actually increasing the intensity of the probe, Kilgallen blasted the ineptness of the government investigations, including that of the Warren Commission. This triggered her belief that most, if not all, of the 18 telephone lines in the townhouse could be tapped, confirmed later by her daughter Jill. On September 3, 1964, Kilgallen noted Journal American coverage of Robert Kennedy's resignation as Attorney General. In his resignation letter, RFK pointed to his seeking to become a United States Senator from New York. Certainly those in the mafia whom Bobby had pursued with hostile vigor cheered his decision. RFK would no longer be a thorn in their side. 10 days later, Kilgallen, 14 months removed from her mystifying death, thanked the legion of readers who had praise for her. "This column owes a great debt of gratitude to the thousands of messages of congratulations that came after the stories on the Jack Ruby testimony before the Warren Commission. They came from William Randolph Hearst, Jr., Walter Winchell, editors and publishers all over the nation, rival columnists, and citizens in many states in the Union who hailed my paper and me for courage in printing the articles. Of course, there was courage involved, but mostly it was the simple urge to print the story. Thank you very much. From an incorrigible reporter, to whom the front page is quite a bit like the Star-Spangled Banner." 11 days later, Kilgallen read with extreme skepticism the Warren Commission report's conclusions. Among them were, "The commission has found no evidence that either Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby was part of any conspiracy, domestic or foreign, to assassinate President Kennedy. There was no direct relationship between Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. No evidence existed that Jack Ruby acted with any other person in the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald." Summarizing, the commission report read, "On the basis of the evidence before the commission, it concludes that Oswald acted alone." One section of the report read, "Based on its evaluation of the record, the commission believes that the evidence does not establish a significant link between Ruby and organized crime. Both state and federal officials have indicated that Ruby was not affiliated with organized crime activities, and numerous persons have reported that Ruby was not connected with such activity. Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission, and later the 38th President of the United States, stated, "There is no doubt in my mind that as far as Ruby was concerned, his murder of Lee Harvey Oswald was not connected in any form to mob connections or foreign connections." To anyone who would listen, and in her Voice of Broadway column, Kilgallen dubbed the report laughable. Regarding the Warren Commission agenda, Kilgallen wrote, "It seemed to me, after reading the testimony three times, that the Chief Justice and the General Counsel were acutely aware of the talk, both here and in Europe, that President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy. They took pains to prove to themselves and the world that no conspiracy existed." Kilgallen's reputation and clout had permitted her to access the original Dallas Police Department log, reflecting radio communications moments after JFK was assassinated. It chronicled police activities by the minute. Left out of the Warren Commission report, Kilgallen realized, was a startling disclosure. It detailed how Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry, seated in the first car in the president's motorcade, reacted to shots fired. He told officers to get man on top of the overpass and see what happened up there. This story had been printed in the Journal American on August 23, 1964, under the headline, "Kilgallen Reports Mix-Up in Dallas." After beginning the article with the words, "A previously unpublished and private report by the Dallas Police Department of events surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy conflicts sharply with some public statements of Dallas police officials," Kilgallen then seized on the conflicting statements. She wrote that Curry's reaction and subsequent orders were at odds with what he subsequently told reporters 24 hours after the assassination. He had said the shots originated from the book depository building. In addition, Kilgallen wrote, Curry had informed reporters that his first order to officers was to have them surround the book depository building. In conclusion, Kilgallen wrote, "As we see from the police department's official version of events, Chief Curry's immediate concern was not the depository, but the triple-tiered overpass overhead, which the president's car was moving at about 8 miles an hour when the fatal shots were fired." In a limited collector's edition of a little-known 1969 book entitled Retired Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry Reveals His Personal JFK Assassination File, secured by this author in 2017, Chief Curry confirms Kilgallen's account, albeit the language is not exactly as she reported it. After observing that the parade route through Dealey Plaza selected by the Secret Service was a dangerous one, since it would have given conspirators every reason to believe the president's open car would pass the site actually chosen for the assassination, Curry wrote, "I did see a few unauthorized people on the overpass and wondered how they had gotten up there." Curry then recalled, "I hear a sharp crack, and two other reports, or shots, came directly after the first." Armed with this information, Curry sent out the following communique on police radio channel 2. "Get man on top of the underpass. See what happened up there. Go up to the overpass." He then added, "I'm sure it's going to take some time to get your men in there. Put every one of my men there." At FBI headquarters in Washington, J. Edgar Hoover displayed his personal anger at Kilgallen's column about the mix-up. In the famed reporter's dossier, obtained by this author through the Freedom of Information Act, the director, in his own handwriting, posted piercing remarks in the margins. The comments related to the facts she included and conclusions reached in her Journal American stories. Hoover wrote "wrong" in longhand next to her comment about the man on the overpass. On another page, Hoover also wrote "wrong" beside the famous columnist's specification of the time when Chief Curry ordered police to check the overpass. J. Edgar Hoover's disdain aside, Dorothy Kilgallen kept pushing forward, to the extent of performing an experiment indicative of her crusade to learn the truth about what happened on November 22nd in Dealey Plaza. The subject of her curiosity was the Warren Commission testimony of a steamfitter named Howard Brennan, who had provided a description of an alleged shooter standing by a sixth-floor book depository window, permitting police to release a physical description. Kilgallen had learned Brennan told police he was sitting on a concrete wall as the presidential motorcade passed through the plaza, one located 100 feet from the book depository window. Brennan said he could see up into the sixth-floor window where someone was holding a rifle. Kilgallen was skeptical, and to that end had her Richard stand at their townhouse window on an upper floor holding in his hands a broomstick, mirroring Oswald holding a rifle. Meanwhile, the curious reporter stood outside on East 68th Street at the same distance as Brennan described. Afterward, she informed Richard that her conclusion was correct. Brennan could not have seen into the window, but most importantly, could not have seen anyone holding a rifle. Kilgallen's obsession with continuing to probe every aspect of the JFK assassination was clear. That she was the only journalist in the world, other than perhaps Mark Lane, actively disagreeing at the time with Hoover's self-proclaimed Oswald alone theory seems nearly impossible, but true. Despite others accepting Hoover's edict, nothing could stop her from pursuing every lead through sources only a reporter of her stature could garner. In the limited edition book, Dallas Police Department Chief Curry mentioned Howard Brennan in a dubious nature. After duplicating what Kilgallen understood his recollections to be, Curry stated, Brennan claimed that only 2 shots were fired from the book depository. Then, on Friday night, November 22nd, he watched a police lineup and was unable to make a positive identification of Oswald. Curry added, Brennan's testimony to FBI agents varied from month to month after the assassinations, but he was later to become the Warren Commission's star witness. When he was willing to positively identify Oswald as the man he saw in the book depository window. In effect, Kilgallen had called the Dallas chief of police a liar. The list of enemies grew. Curry, Hoover, and the FBI, the CIA, the Justice Department, Warren Commission members and attorneys, and anyone complicit in the JFK and Oswald assassinations. When Kilgallen read the Warren Commission report, Ruby's close friendship with a plethora of Dallas Police Department officers, as noted at his trial, was ignored, even though this evidence proved Oswald's killer could move easily among the police when Oswald was being interrogated. And later, when he ended up in the Dallas Police Department jail basement with access to JFK's alleged assassin. In addition, Kilgallen realized many other significant facts testified to had been left out of the Ruby Warren Commission testimony, or discarded as insignificant, giving the appearance that the commission members had cherry-picked evidence solidifying the Oswald alone theory. Among crucial testimony rendered insignificant included that from the parking lot owner G.C. Hallmark, who had testified during the Ruby trial that Ruby said he would be there when Oswald was transferred, a striking comment of enormous historical importance pointing dead center toward Ruby being part of a conspiracy. When Kilgallen perused the Warren Commission report, she noticed a section indicating that Ruby went to the Nichols parking garage adjacent to the Carousel Club, where he was seen by Garnet C. Hallmark, general manager of the garage, and Tom Brown, an attendant. After leaving Dealey Plaza during the early hours of the afternoon of Saturday the 23rd, the day before he shot Oswald. Further, Kilgallen read that Brown, apparently overhearing Ruby on the public phone, heard Ruby mention Chief Curry's name, while Hallmark stated that Ruby told him he was acting like a reporter. Hallmark further stated Ruby addressed someone at the other end of the telephone and caught portions of a conversation concerning the transfer of Oswald, while remarking to the recipient of the call, "You know I'll be there." Hallmark's important account of these five words being spoken, Kilgallen knew, was even more direct than what he had testified at Ruby's trial. But to her dismay, it had been left out of any conclusions reached by the Warren Commission regarding Ruby when it decided Oswald's killer wasn't a part of any conspiracy. Kilgallen also knew that Dallas Morning News ad salesman John Newman had confirmed at the trial that Ruby was in its offices at nearly the exact time JFK was assassinated, all while being directly in front of or near a window exposing Dealey Plaza and the sixth floor of the book depository. Nothing about this testimony was included in the Warren Commission report. One may only imagine the shock Kilgallen experienced when she realized so much was missing in the report from the Ruby trial. This included testimony from Dallas Morning News reporter John Rutledge, who had noted Ruby's apparent close friendship with D.A. Henry Wade, calling him Henry, not Mr. Wade, when Ruby set up the D.A.'s telephone call on the Friday night of Oswald's news conference. Rutledge had also testified to another important fact, that Ruby said, "I am helping out all these fellows," referring to other reporters, and that he had a notebook and pencil in his hand, the working tools of a reporter. That testimony connected with Officer T.D. McMillan, who said Ruby had admitted he could always act like a reporter, and that he had just ducked his head and kept going when he entered the DPD jail basement. In the Warren Commission report, Kilgallen noted that Rutledge echoed much of his Ruby trial testimony, that Ruby had appeared on the third floor of the Dallas Police Department just before midnight on the 22nd. Rutledge added, "I saw Jack and two out-of-state reporters to go around the corner where Captain Fritz's office was, and Jack was bent over like this, writing on a piece of paper and talking to one of the reporters and pointing to something on the piece of paper. He was kind of hunched over." To Kilgallen, Rutledge's Warren Commission testimony was even more compelling than it had been at trial. It pointed to Ruby not only acting like a reporter, confirming Hallmark's testimony, but also mentioning that Ruby was bent over like this, kind of hunched over, a clear indication Ruby had infiltrated police headquarters on a floor near where Oswald was being interrogated, while attempting to hide the fact that he had no business there. Once again, Kilgallen knew this critical evidence that Ruby was stalking Oswald was nowhere mentioned in the commission report conclusions, ignored, despite its historical importance pointing to Ruby being part of a conspiracy. Striking to an accomplished reporter like Kilgallen was the Warren Commission report describing Ruby's actions as he parked near the DPD building on Sunday at around 11 a.m., the day he assassinated Oswald. The report revealed Ruby parked his car in a lot directly across the street from the Western Union office. He apparently placed his keys and billfold in the trunk of the car, then locked the trunk, which contained approximately $1,000 in cash, and placed the trunk key in the glove compartment. He did not lock the car. Added was the information that, with his revolver, more than $2,000 in cash and no personal identification, Ruby walked from the parking lot across the street to the Western Union office. It appears quite plausible Kilgallen would have asked herself the same two questions anyone who wasn't brain dead would have asked. Why did Ruby act as he did if he wasn't fulfilling his Saturday telephone promise? He would be there, with the full intent of killing Oswald in the DPD jail basement while deliberately leaving behind personal identification. In addition, if Ruby had been telling the truth about just happening upon Oswald's transfer, why had Ruby discarded the identification, left his keys in the trunk of his car, locked it, and taken his revolver with him? Again, she knew, this vital evidence had been ignored by the Warren Commission because, it appeared clear to her, the members had their own agenda, being a rubber stamp for Hoover's Oswald Alone proclamation. continually astonished as she made note after note in her ever-thickening JFK assassination file, Kilgallen must have realized that the cover-up instigated by J. Edgar Hoover moments after JFK was killed, and then when Ruby assassinated Oswald, had now stretched to the Warren Commission. She knew the commission's findings were bogus, since so much of the testimony pointing toward a conspiracy that Kilgallen had heard firsthand was nowhere to be found in its Ruby documents. On the flip side, Hoover and his cohorts in the Justice Department must have realized the discrepancies between the Ruby trial testimony and the Ruby Warren Commission testimony, but it appeared most of the press was brain dead and did not report the discrepancies, either out of fear of offending Hoover or because they were simply lazy and didn't check the facts. To Hoover and anyone involved in the JFK assassination, Kilgallen was like rolling thunder, a serious threat requiring daily monitoring so as to discover what the dogged reporter might discover next. What would really be of benefit was to insert a mole in Kilgallen's camp, her inner circle, someone she trusted who could provide updates on her investigation in general and what she intended to write in her Random House book. Meanwhile, Jack Ruby, the condemned man, attempted suicide 3 times in late 1964, first by standing 20 feet from a concrete wall and then running headfirst into the wall. The second attempt involved use of an electric light socket, with the result of a few burns on his hands and arms. Finally, Ruby tied his pant legs together and attempted to hang himself, but the knot he tied loosened as a guard rushed into his cell. Reading of Ruby's attempts to kill himself saddened Kilgallen, since she believed, like Oswald, that Ruby was a patsy, used by those who masterminded the JFK assassination. She told friends she actually felt badly for him, especially while pondering the puzzling statement Ruby made after appearing before the Warren Commission. "The world will never know the true facts of what occurred. My motives. The people who had, that had so much to gain and had such a material motive to put me in this position I'm in, would never let the true facts come above board to the world." While future events dictated that it would have been much better if Kilgallen had kept her mouth shut about the investigation, a year and a half or so removed from her untimely death, she was instead a blabbermouth. To that end, she told friend Marlon Swing several times, "This had to be a conspiracy. Johnny Ray, What's My Line associate producer Bob Bach, and her makeup man, Carmen Gabia, also were told of her belief that the Warren Commission report was bogus, even though her attorney, Mort Farber, suggested she keep quiet about the conclusions she was reaching as to who assassinated JFK and by whom. She told Farber, "I'm going to break the real story and have the biggest scoop of the century," a remark that must have filtered through her townhouse with Sinclair, Clement, and Simpson paying close attention. If there was one person Kilgallen trusted more than any other, it was Mark Lane. And in a December 10th, 1964 Voice of Broadway column, she plugged his upcoming book. She wrote, "Mark Lane, the attorney who leads the opposition to the Warren Commission's report on the assassination of President Kennedy, is studying thousands of pages of testimony in preparation for his book on the tragedy. Titled Rush to Judgment, it will be published by Grove Press in the spring and promises to contain many hitherto unrevealed surprises." Lane's book was released in 1966 by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Keeping a confidence, Kilgallen never mentioned what Lane's surprises were, but she stalled her own investigation while keeping her assassination file close at hand as the winter months of 1964 to 1965 turned to spring and summer. In Zurich, Kilgallen told friends she was working on her Random House book while seeking ways to improve her health, since her fast-paced, busy-bee schedule had worn the media icon down. Upon returning to the U.S., Johnny Ray was quite impressed with Kilgallen's appearance. He stated she was plumper, her color was higher. Unknown to Kilgallen or Ray, their relationship had become a topic of conversation between JFK and Laura Bergquist Knebel, a journalist for Look magazine. The topic was whether Jackie was a political asset for her husband during the 1960 election. Apparently, Kilgallen was among the columnists who had suggested Jackie was too fancy, too fey, or excessively refined, and too social to become a president's wife. And the American people would never accept that kind of person. Kilgallen had also written, according to Knebel, a number of snide items about Jackie, implying that she wasn't really pregnant, that this was ruse to keep her out of the campaign. When Knebel asked JFK about this, Knebel said the future president replied, "Oh yeah, but what can you expect from a dame who's in love with Johnny Ray?" Regardless, on January 20th, 1965, Kilgallen decided to recall the days when JFK and First Lady Jackie occupied the White House. The column was entitled, "I Remember Jackie." Kilgallen wrote, "It is impossible, on this inaugural day, not to think of the young woman who watched with wide-eyed pride as John Fitzgerald Kennedy took his oath of office 4 years ago. She was like a new kind of first lady to all of us. She looked like a princess doll that a good little girl might find under her tree on Christmas morning." Good health in tow, Kilgallen made plans to continue her JFK assassination investigation as the month neared when she would be silenced forever. Speaking with Mark Lane, she told him she was headed for Dallas, explaining, "Back on the trail. I expect I am going to learn a lot this time." If her phones were being tapped, as she suspected, enemies certainly knew of her plans. On the following day, the news spotlight was on a Texas hearing considering Jack Ruby's sanity, scheduled as part of the appeal process. Kilgallen read with interest what Ruby told a federal court judge. "I never had any defense. I never had any defense." A conclusion Kilgallen had reached after watching the antics of Melvin Belli at trial with regard to the ludicrous psychomotor epilepsy insanity defense he attempted to get the jury to swallow. On September 3, 1965, just 64 days before she died, Kilgallen published her final column about the JFK and Oswald assassinations. She wrote, "Those close to the scene realize that if the widow of Lee Harvey Oswald, now married to another chap, ever gave out the whole story of her life with President Kennedy's alleged assassin, it would split open the front pages of newspapers all over the world." Most importantly, Kilgallen perhaps sealed her fate when she wrote of a prediction in the column, one sending a clear signal to those threatened by her continuing investigation. "This story is not going to die as long as there's a real reporter alive. And there are a lot of them." Unfortunately, real reporters, ones with Kilgallen's integrity and fearless nature, were scarce, if not non-existent, with most swallowing Hoover's wail of a lie that Oswald alone had killed Kennedy, like a gumdrop. Instead, she stood alone, the only journalist in the world willing to take on those who had killed the 35th President of the United States. Further into September, Kilgallen eased into Barbara Walters' Father Lou's Latin Quarter nightclub, originally known as the Cotton Club and the Palais d'Or, located at Broadway and West 47th Street. Headliners who had appeared there included Ella Fitzgerald, Patti Page, and Milton Berle. But Kilgallen watched Johnny Ray perform from a backstage perch. The following month, a newspaper strike stopped the presses in New York City. With time to spare, Kilgallen joined host Gore Vidal and guest David Susskind on the popular WPIX radio program Hot Line. The subject of the JFK assassination, to her dismay, was left out of the discussion. Kilgallen's columns during this time mostly centered on entertainment issues. An example was an October 5th column entitled "Who'll Succeed Johnny?", with her speculating either Jerry Lewis or Tony Randall would take over the reins of The Tonight Show. Another column posted on the 27th, 12 days before she died, was a scoop with the headline, "Elvis to Star as the Midnight Cowboy?" Kilgallen speculated that director Mark Rydell had the King of Rock and Roll to play Joe Buck, with Kilgallen commenting, "Not a bad idea. Elvis might be perfect for the role." The exception was when Kilgallen addressed the continuing saga of the controversial Vietnam War. On October 20th, part of a column stated, "The FBI has been alerted. There are even more big student demonstrations being planned at colleges and universities this year, in protest against our Vietnam policy, of course." 6 days later, the October 26th column's headline was, "Diplomats See Early Viet War End." With her editors having shortened Vietnam to Viet, she wrote, "High echelon figures in diplomacy are again deeply involved in trying to bring about a halt to the Vietnam War. Peace may come far sooner than expected, possibly early in 1966. The column did not identify the diplomats and was otherwise general in nature. When Kilgallen's hairdresser Sinclair was asked whether she had expressed a bias for or against the burgeoning American involvement in Vietnam, he replied, yes, she opposed American involvement. Finally, having secured enough fresh evidence about JFK's death to make the trip worthwhile, Kilgallen flew to New Orleans. Accompanying her was her hairdresser and close friend Mark Sinclair. He was quite prominent in his own right, and his name often appeared in the NYC newspapers. Among his clients were Bennett Cerf's wife Phyllis, and when they visited the United States, Princess Margaret, and her husband, Anthony Armstrong Jones, the Earl of Snowden. Mark Sinclair's journey to becoming Kilgallen's main hairdresser, close friend and confidant, is a long and winding one, with a connection to Jackie Kennedy. Sinclair's interest in hairstyling came by accident. When he moved from Florida to New York City, where the action was, at age 17 in 1952, his first job was as an apprentice photographer for the Ladies' Home Journal. Soon, Sinclair was helping a fashion photographer there when he started fooling around with the model's hair. He became hooked with styling, and his parents granted a request to pay for him to attend beauty school in Manhattan. In 1960, Kilgallen noticed the trendy popularity of French hairstyles in New York. She knew that these hairstyles required frequent adjustments by a hairdresser, and she started visiting the hair salon in the Lily Daché building on East 56th Street in Manhattan. Daché, French-born, was a ladies' hat maker who had supplied the revered reporter with fancy hats for many years. When the new, snazzy French hairstyles made wearing hats difficult, Daché set aside an entire floor of her building for hairstyling. That same year, 5 years before she died, Dorothy began visiting the hairdressing floor in the Daché building. It was set aside for young hairdressers, including Sinclair and his Florida friend Charles Simpson, also born in 1935. The head hairdresser there was Kenneth Battelle. Kilgallen started using him to style her hair, but Sinclair sometimes filled in when Battelle was working away from Manhattan. Meanwhile, Battelle became First Lady Jackie Kennedy's personal hairdresser, starting shortly after she recovered from her near-fatal childbirth to John Jr. in November 1960. Once the inauguration was over, Jackie began bringing Battelle with her to various locations, often the White House. But for 2 years, until the spring of 1963, Battelle remained in charge of the Daché Salon. After 2 years of following the First Lady all over the world to fix her hair immediately before various public events, Battelle announced he was opening his own Manhattan salon, where Jackie could visit during her frequent visits to New York City. Note, Battelle styled Jackie's hair before she left with JFK for Dallas on the fateful trip. Lily Dache made Mark Sinclair the new head hairdresser in her building. Kilgallen now had a choice, Battelle or Sinclair. The deciding factor, according to Sinclair, was that Battelle had not always been nice to Dorothy. And while his assistant, Rosemary Sorrentino, treated Dorothy well, Kilgallen did not like her. Kilgallen decided Sinclair would be in charge of styling her hair from then on, and Simpson, who first worked at Saks Fifth Avenue, would fill in during times when Sinclair worked elsewhere. When Kilgallen's daughter, Jill, married in 1963, she invited Sinclair and Simpson to the wedding at the Plaza Hotel. Both of them became friendly with Jill during the early part of her marriage, and soon after, Kilgallen gave Sinclair a key to her brownstone on East 68th, and he and Simpson became her only hairdressers after that time. During the next 2 years, until she died, Sinclair, along with butler James Clement, became her best friend. In a videotaped interview, Sinclair recalled the strange set of circumstances prevailing during the New Orleans trip. "Dorothy didn't tell me why we were going. She just asked me if I could go with her, and I said yes. She told me how I was to travel, where I was to go, what I was to do. And I'd never been to New Orleans before, so I didn't know anything about it." Selected excerpts from Sinclair videotaped interview are available at www.thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Sinclair added, 6 weeks before she died, she, Kilgallen, went down to New Orleans on a plane, and I went down on another at the same time. And I stayed at a different hotel than she did. We were going to have dinner that evening, and I'd done her hair. She called me and she said, "I want you to leave immediately. I don't want you to tell anyone you were ever here with me. I don't want anyone to know you were ever here with me. And don't ask me any more questions." And I got on the plane and flew back to New York. He further stated, "I was upset. I didn't know why she was sending me away, and she didn't tell me until she got back." Asked what he learned, Sinclair said, "I did know from Dorothy finally that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK, that it was a group of people, not one. She told me." Asked if he recalled seeing a newspaper photograph of Kilgallen standing beside two men in New Orleans, Sinclair said, "Yes." He agreed the newspaper was probably the Daily Mirror, a tabloid in circulation, since the major New York City newspaper workers were on strike. The hairdresser couldn't recall who the two men were. "It was a small photograph," he said, "and she had on a suit, and she was very well done. And I looked at it because she was in it, and the caption said, 'Dorothy Kilgallen in New Orleans.'" Sinclair added, "I find it strange that she would be photographed in New Orleans, especially after she told me to leave. And I find it strange that she was photographed at all. I don't think she wanted to be photographed. I'm not sure now that I think about it. I'm not sure that photograph was posed for. I think it was caught." In the audiotaped interview, Sinclair said, "I don't know who she was meeting in New Orleans. She didn't tell me much about that meeting, period. Never did. And I knew enough not to ask any more. There were certain things where she drew a blank wall. She just didn't want me to know any more about it. Maybe she was frightened at that point." With her death on the near horizon, Kilgallen planned a second trip to New Orleans. When asked by What's My Line makeup artist Carmen Gabia, "Is it Kennedy?" she replied, "Yes, and it's very cloak and daggerish. I'm going to meet a source whom I do not know, but will recognize, who is going to give me information about the case." Adding to the intrigue, as November 8, 1965 approached, were stinging words Kilgallen used in a conversation with Charles Simpson, a serious-minded, round-faced gay man who could keep a secret and knew Sinclair from their days in Florida. In a videotaped interview, Simpson said Kilgallen startled him when she said, "I used to share things with you. But after I have found out now what I know, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life." Keeping this statement in mind, Kilgallen definitely was feeling the heat based on the substantial evidence she had gathered about the JFK assassination, especially from her exclusive interviews with Jack Ruby. The substance of the testimony she watched and heard at the Ruby trial, and her mystifying trip to New Orleans, with another planned in the near future. Since she had focused on Ruby from the get-go after JFK's death, Kilgallen must have been startled to hear on November 4, 1965, 4 days before she died, that an Associated Press article appeared regarding an important development in Jack Ruby's case. It read in part, "Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade said today his office is willing to recommend that Jack Ruby's death sentence be reduced to life imprisonment." Among Wade's comments were, "There is an advantage to keeping Ruby alive, for interviews and historical purposes. There are still a lot of unanswered questions." Wade gave no further explanation, and Ruby's sentence was never commuted to life imprisonment. Wade's decision to commute Ruby's sentence confirmed Kilgallen's belief that yes, there were a lot of unanswered questions, and she was determined more than ever to find out the answers. To those threatened with exposure through her efforts, Kilgallen was a walking stick of dynamite, since there was little doubt she would be visiting Texas to interview Ruby if he was spared the electric chair. He had trusted her with the previous interviews, and knew she had kept her word not to print or divulge to anyone the contents of their discussion. If there was one person in the world Jack Ruby could trust, it was definitely Dorothy Kilgallen. As Saturday, November 6th, dawned, Mark Sinclair spoke with the famed columnist. In his videotaped interview, he said, "We talked for about an hour. Her life had been threatened." During the early evening hours of the 7th, Sinclair assisted Kilgallen as she readied herself for her final What's My Line program. When the popular show ended at 11 p.m. or so, Kilgallen and Bob Bach sped by limousine to P.J. Clark's on 3rd Avenue for a nightcap. First established in 1884 and once owned by an Irish immigrant named Patrick J. Clark, it was called the Vatican of Saloons by the New York Times. Its fame included visits on a regular basis from Jackie Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, who normally wore sunglasses, Humphrey Bogart, Truman Capote, Ted Kennedy, and mafia boss Frank Costello. Kilgallen and Bach were seated at a table toward the back of the bar restaurant near the rear exit. After less than an hour of chatting, the witching hour of 12 o'clock approached on the last night of her life. Suddenly, Kilgallen told Bach she had a late date without disclosing who the date might be. He walked her to her limousine and returned to P.J. Clark's for another round of drinks. After a short ride across town, Kilgallen entered the Regency Hotel bar at 540 Park Avenue, less than a mile from Clark's, 6 blocks from her townhouse, within a half hour, depending on traffic. Seated in a corner booth where the lights were dimmed, Kurt Meyer, the piano player, said she was joined by a man, and he recalled her being there until at least 2 a.m. Hours later, with the exact time span becoming a matter of conjecture, Kilgallen, the most powerful female voice in America, was found dead at age 52, lying in a bed at her East 68th Street townhouse. The JFK assassination file she had compiled for 18 months and counting was missing. As if to signal a distress from the heavens concerning the passing of one of the most remarkable women in history, what became known as the Northeast Blackout of 1965 happened the next day, the 9th. Along with New York City, the supply of electricity was disrupted to millions of people in portions of Canada, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Like the electricity, Kilgallen had been turned off, her voice silenced once and for all.